This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity, designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. Gainbridge is helping build a better financial future for women. Retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower. Now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Episode 10, Don and Tom, Days of Blunder. Where it went all wrong for Don and Tom Cruise. In this episode, we go into what went so right on Don and Tom's critically panned and vastly underrated unofficial sequel to Top Gun. And we go into what went so terribly, terribly wrong on a production that went so wildly over budget that Paramount chief Frank Mancuso, in a fitful rage, blew up Don's $300 million deal like one of his fiery race car crashes. A definitive case of life imitating art. Days of Thunder was notable for Tom Cruise's transformation into a professional stock race car driver, and for Don's not-so-amazing transformation into becoming a movie star. That's right, this is the film where Don makes his big-screen studio debut. And as you might have guessed, movie stardom would not come easily for Don. January 10th, 1990. It was one of those crisp, clear LA days when locals can't help but feel a little smug to be living in the California sunshine. Don, a perpetually smug man, was feeling exceedingly so. He had just gotten a green light and $50 million, three times that of Top Gun, to make another movie with Tom Cruise. No two men in Hollywood were hotter than Don and Tom. Tom was so invested in the story that he took a story-by credit for the first and only time in his career. Don was taking on a new hyphenate as well, producer/actor.
Don was starring in a movie opposite Tom Cruise. I repeat, Don Simpson was starring in a movie opposite Tom Cruise. That was the talk of the town. Of course, it was Don that was doing all the talking. His CAA buddies laughed at him, calling out bullshit. And why wouldn't they? Don had told some pretty tall tales over the years.
But this time around, the agents came to realize that Don was serious. "Send me scripts," Don told them. "Not to produce, but to star in. Because after Days of Thunder, I'm going to be very, very busy." Don had pretty good reason to be confident. He had hired the great Robert Town, screenwriter of Chinatown, to write the script and a part for him. For Don, Town conceived a suave, devastatingly handsome Italian race car driver that would challenge Tom Cruise's character, Cole Trickle. Don was so excited he immediately got to work designing his race car, a Chevy Lumina number 34 in hot pink and bright green and black. If you go online, you can find toy replicas for sale. Aside from getting to design his awesome race car, Don also got an awesome name.
Aldo Benedetti. I remember the first time he told me. I said, "Don, that's a movie star name." With a name like that, you're going to overshadow Cruise. Don laughed. That's Cruise's problem.
There is little known about the backstory of Aldo Benedetti. We know that most race car drivers were Southern. Don couldn't do a Southern accent. If Don was going to be in the movie, he would have to play an outsider. Now, the only outsider driving in NASCAR at the time was the great Mario Andretti. It was a perfect fit. Andretti personified Don's lifestyle of pushing the envelope.
When the racing car is working perfectly, that's what makes the entire effort worthwhile. The designers, the mechanics, everyone is just trying to get the perfect machine. And it's so difficult to do that when you finally have it in your hands, you cherish that moment so much. I can express myself with it. I have a tool in my hands that I can just almost sing with. It's almost a moment of glory.
Now, Don couldn't call himself Mario. That would be too obvious. But Mario had a twin brother, Aldo. Aldo Andretti. How about Aldo Benedetti? Bingo. Aldo was more than a name for Don. It was a reality. A reality that Don had a major role in a major movie opposite a major movie star. In a movie where Don, as producer, had complete control. It was like a Clint Eastwood project where Clint was the director and the star. This was Don's vanity project.
I've never seen Don look in the mirror as much as he did in preparation for Days of Thunder. There were wall-to-wall mirrors in the bathroom, the bedroom, the hallways. Don knew how cruelly the camera can capture one's flaws. The mirrors were Don's way of making sure he looked good no matter what the angle. The problem, or should I say the challenge, Don had in getting in good enough shape where he could stand next to the biggest movie star heartthrob in the world in Tom Cruise, was that Don had spent the past decade partying like Keith Richards. He quickly realised he couldn't party and pump iron. He would have to get sober. Then he had to lose the weight and get rid of the wrinkles and the eye bags. There were nips and tucks to be done, a brow lift, cheek implants, a new jawline, a tummy tuck, a butt lift. And that was just the first go around.
Over the next 5 years, Don would go under the knife many times. He would disappear for months, only to come back a whole new Don with a whole new body and a whole new face.
Don had access to movie stars and thus had access to all the best surgeons. He knew who had had good work and who hadn't. He was a 45-year-old with a 20-year substance addiction. Going under the knife wasn't a last resort. It was a first resort. And Don was thrilled with the results.
All except, the penile implant. Or enlargement, or whatever you want to call his surgery. How? Why? So many questions on this one. There were rumors that Don had flown out to see a doctor in Germany that had worked on a movie star that Don knew quite well. This movie star was keen on all sorts of enlargement electives. He was known to have a penis pump in his trailer that he would clamp on during downtime on set. There were PAs that attested to hearing the noise of the pump outside the trailer. All this to say, getting pumped up, whether in the gym or otherwise, was not uncommon for certain A-list male movie stars in the late 1980s. Enlargements aside, the most important aspect of Don's preparation were the surgical procedures. He knew he'd be wearing a matching racing suit opposite Tom Cruise. And if you look at the photos of Don and Tom in production stills from the movie, Don holds his own. He looks, well, kind of like a movie star. Now, of course, the studio wasn't paying Don millions in upfront fees along with a future percentage of first dollar box office gross to be a movie star. They were paying Don to produce the movie.
The fact of the matter was, Tom was doing more of the producing than Don was. Don had always brought the big idea. That's what made the Don Simpson movie so special. But this time around, it was Tom Cruise's idea. Paul Newman had taken Tom to the racetrack, and Tom fell in love with the sport.
Flying in a jet was glorious, but in a race car, it's a battle. You know, during a race, you're in there, you know, every second. I love flying an F-14, so if I had my choice, I'd be racing.
Tom got hooked on driving stock cars in the way that only Tom Cruise can. He competed in races against real drivers, and won.
The green flag is down, and Cruz moves out ahead of the Porsche number 8 in GT2. Cruz appears to be in full control here, demonstrating the kind of smoothness and continuity that's been the trademark of the Newman Sharp Racing Team.
How does the gearbox feel, Tom?
Feels good.
Okay, buddy, nice and easy, nice and smooth, nice and smooth.
To convince himself to join Top Gun, Tom had taken a jet ride with the Blue Angels. Now it took driving a Nissan stock car 175 miles per hour around the track for Tom to be convinced.
It was Tom and not Don who immersed himself in the research. Tom spent months hanging out with a NASCAR crowd. Many of the stories Tom heard found their way into the movie.
Like Richard Petty's famously devastating wreck at the Daytona 500, which left him temporarily blind.
There's a crash coming out of turn 4, Cole.
Can't see anything.
Look at your fingers for me. Look at your toes.
I can't see anything.
Tell me what's going on. I'm blind, God.
And all the great dialogue that came from NASCAR owner Rick Hendrick and his buddies, like dropping the hammer.
I'm dropping the hammer.
No, you're not.
And the famous line from crew chief Harry Hyde, "Rubbin, son." Is racing.
Okay, I'm gonna pull this rookie's chain.
Cole, you're wandering all over the track.
Yeah, well, the son of a bitch just slammed into me.
No, he didn't slam into you, he didn't bump you, he didn't nudge you, he rubbed you. And rubbing's son is racing.
And Hendrick's line, we look like a monkey fucking a football.
I had sponsors in the stands, and I'm hugging and holding hands and kissing them in the air and praying for a good showing. And what do? We end up looking like a monkey fucking a football out there.
Robert Town would be the credited writer on Days of Thunder. But before bringing in Town, Tom brought in Donald Stewart, a big auto racing fan who had won an Oscar for the Jack Lemmon film Missing. Don and Tom weren't seeing eye to eye, and so they brought back old pal Warren Scarron. Warren had helped to smooth out the disputes between Don and Tom on Top Gun, but he couldn't do the same on Thunder. Don wanted to use the Top Gun template, a sort of Top Gun on wheels, while Tom wanted a more talky, character-driven piece.
That was a very big blow when Warren left the picture. At that time, Don had already lost his closest ally, Dawn Steele. Dawn had been with Don since the beginning.
Until Ned Tannen fired Dawn while she was giving birth at Cedar Sinai.
I have to tell you that it was a difficult day, if you will. And after 17 or 18 hours of labor and an emergency C-section, you know, I was relieved. I had this healthy child in my arms. I was healthy. My husband went out for a minute and came back, and his face was white, and he was carrying the trade papers, Variety. And on the front page of Variety, it basically said that I had lost my job while I was in labor.
She would go on to become the first female studio head at Columbia. Without Don Steele in his corner, Don had nobody to back him up. Robert Town and Tom Cruise were both at the top of their game. Don couldn't push those guys around. Not when it came to the screenplay.
Tom and Don and Robert Town didn't agree on much during the writing phase, but they did have the Tim Richmond story. Tim was always the inspiration for Cole Trickle, and I implored Don, just go all in and tell the Tim Richmond story. You'll win awards. It was the best story in sport at the time.
When we return, we go into NASCAR's betrayal of the legendary driver, Tim Richmond.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Don't forget to pack the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies for a post-lunch pick-me-up. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
We went from normal life, healthy child, to acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between award-winning mattress brand Leesa and home design favorite West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is the culmination of these two companies' shared values: premium materials, meticulous craftsmanship, and sustainable practices. Made with natural latex, responsibly sourced natural wool, and environmentally safe foams, the Natural Hybrid elevates your sleep sanctuary. Indulges your senses and supports a greener tomorrow. Plus, when you purchase the Natural Hybrid, you're also helping fuel Leesa's work with shelters and those in need. Since 2015, Leesa has donated more than 40,000 mattresses to ensure children and families have a safe place to sleep. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Leesa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit leesa.com/iHeart. That's leesa.com/iHeart.
Now, Hollywood Tim Richmond, what are you trying to prove?
I'm trying to prove that I was put on this earth to have fun, to succeed at the fun department.
Tim Richmond was not your typical stock car driver. For one thing, he was a Yankee, the only one on the circuit. He was known to wear fur coats and Ferragamo loafers. He kept an apartment in New York City, a party boat in Florida. He hung out with celebrities and centerfolds. He was the Joe Namath of drivers. The sport had never seen anyone like him.
Don and I went to Riverside. Tim had pulled out a 25-car lead on the back straightaway with only about 3 miles to finish before he'd take the flag. He'd been in his car for over 2 hours, and there's no air conditioning in these cars. The track must have been 120 degrees. Tim told me later he lost 6 pounds of water weight just from sweat.
Tim had won the race at Riverside, but the commentator, Richard Petty, one of the legends in the sport, noted Tim had an advantage. He hadn't raced in 6 months. He was more rested.
Well rested? That couldn't have been further from the truth. Nobody knew how bad it was. He was battling AIDS. The double pneumonia was just the beginning. Tim was dying.
Tim, do you have a drug problem?
I'm sorry, but that question has been asked more than once here, more than once by everybody, and I am not answering that question. I am going to let the drug test in Daytona answer it, and NASCAR can answer it for y'all. And if they don't answer it the right way, then I'll have my little bottle, and there will be another answer there. Because I know whether it's dirty or whether it's clean, and it is clean.
Pneumonia, you've said it all along. The rumor mill, as we said, has claimed drugs, AIDS.
There were widespread rumors that a NASCAR driver had falsified his drug tests. NASCAR couldn't prove he had HIV, but they could ensure he would never race again. Without any available medical treatments for HIV, Tim would go home to his parents' house in Fort Lauderdale to die. NASCAR had abandoned him. A racing legend was now a ghost. He was just 34 years old when he died.
I said, "Wonder how Tim's doing." He said, "Barry, he's got AIDS." I said, no, he doesn't, Dale. He said, "I'm telling you, he has AIDS." And I picked up the paper, I believe, Monday morning or something like that. And it's great big bold headlines, Tim Richmond dies of AIDS.
Picture it. Days of Thunder, the Tim Richmond story. A lone wolf race car driver lives life on the edge, taking on the good old boys of NASCAR only to hide a dark and tragic secret. It would be Tom Cruise in his Academy Award-winning AIDS movie, a prelude to Tom Hanks in Philadelphia 2 years later. They would make a tearjerker with a social message inside an action movie with incredible, heart-pounding driving sequences. Picture Tom and Don accepting the Oscar on the Academy Awards stage at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. What might have been? Now, it's not a surprise that Don and his team would avoid the real story of Tim Richmond. This was the late 1980s. Reagan was still in office, and AIDS was vilified amongst conservatives. A NASCAR action movie with an AIDS storyline in 1989? No way.
Don, for all his flaws, was an open progressive. He hated NASCAR's redneck culture. I mean, you can imagine the NASCAR execs scratching their heads when Don came into their office and pitched the movie. He'd had the cheek implants and the brow lift and the butt lift. He's not walking so well. His face doesn't yet have normal movement. Who is this Hollywood guy in the cowboy boots and the funny face that doesn't move, they were all asking. I mean, I won't sugarcoat it. It wasn't Don's finest hour. Fortunately, he had Tom Cruise with him. Tom makes a big presentation on how Days of Thunder is going to do for NASCAR what Top Gun did for the Navy. It must have helped knowing that Tom had dedicated the last year of his life racing stock cars and could totally speak their language. They were all in awe of Tom. Don could feel it in the room. Days wouldn't be another Don Simpson movie. This was going to be a Tom Cruise movie.
Tom managed to get NASCAR to commit to something quite extraordinary. They would allow cars built by the production team to race in Winston Cup races. They could then use that real racing footage in the movie. Tony Scott and cinematographer Ward Russell would film the cars using camera rigs, rigs that would forever change how auto racing would be filmed.
You're always trying to cover a different aspect of the race or the stunt. Here we're trying to get cameras inside the car, underneath the cars, so we're photographing these stunts in positions I don't think people have done them before.
You also had stunt guys in real races and doing actual crashes. A few times I sat in with Don at meetings with the production keys. They'd all gather around Tony. He'd have his shirt off, smoking a cigar. He'd line up matchbox cars on the table and flip them over, choreographing how many flips and turns he wanted. He really was like a little boy.
In order to film realistic crashes, Tony Scott had his team recreate some of the most violent crashes in racing history.
They'd wreck the cars one day, and the next they'd have the cars in the shop to be repaired. And then they'd wreck another car. It would cost them millions of dollars. It was a real macho thing between Tony and Don. How many cars could they wreck? For that big crash where Cole and Rowdy get hurt, Tony had one car rigged with explosives that would shoot out a sawed-off section of telephone pole that would launch the car into a barrel roll. Mind you, there were stunt drivers stuck inside. These cars would be twisted up in molten steel with smoke coming out from all sides. I tell you, it was pure madness.
The mantra in production was authenticity. How far could the guys go to create the most realistic driving movie ever made?
There was this one scene where Cole Trickle and Rowdy Burns drag race through the streets. They end up taking the race onto the beach. Anyway, Tony Scott gets the great idea to add the effect of live birds scattering away to show just how fast the guys were driving. The production assistants would lure the birds with birdseed. After the first take, all of the birds had been run over.
This was the sort of reckless spending in filmmaking that invoked the ire of Paramount head Frank Mancuso. There were screaming matches between Mancuso and Don. It was a tension similar to what Don had experienced on Top Gun. And like Top Gun, Don reacted to the pressure in the only way he knew how.
So much cocaine. Don was out of control. There was no other word to describe it.
When we return, Don turns spring break into his own private party and has a falling out with Tom.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Don't forget to pack the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies for a post-lunch pick-me-up. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
We went from normal life, healthy child, to acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
Tired of restless nights? Meet Lisa, the sleep expert.
Here at Lisa, we know that good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. That's why their mattresses are made for exceptional comfort and support, catering to every sleep need. Check out Lisa's Sapira Hybrid Mattress, named Best Hybrid Mattress 5 years running. Sleep hot? The Chill Collection is built with cool-to-the-touch top fabric and layers of high-density comfort foams, all intended to remove excess body heat while maximizing comfort. With Lisa, getting a new mattress has never been easier. Delivery is free, and you have 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. Don't spend another night dreaming of better sleep. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus two free pillows. Go to lisa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. That's leesa.com/iHeart. Exclusions apply. See lisa.com for more details.
We were in Daytona during spring break for the college kids. Every night there was a big rap party. One night, Don rents out an entire strip club, and to promote the movie, he uses his special effects team to blow up a race car in front of the club. The car is literally on fire, made to look like a car crash. You would walk into the club and see a burning race car with nobody doing anything about it. It was nuts, totally nuts. I remember another time I was staying at the Hilton. This was in Charlotte. I'd been out late at a club with Don the night before. I was trying to sleep in when I hear drilling coming from the floor below. I go down to find Don overseeing a production crew. They're cutting holes in the wall of every room on the second floor. I said to Don, "Why are your guys drilling holes in the walls?" And Don looks at me and says, "So everybody can go from room to room without having to go out into the hallway." I mean, who thinks like that? To be so meticulous in planning a party that you reconfigure an entire floor of a hotel in the middle of a film production. A production, by the way, that was already terribly, terribly out of control.
It should be noted that Don, who seldom had girlfriends, had a girlfriend during production. Well, at least for the first part of production. Her name was Donna Wilson. She was an aspiring actress, and Don made sure she had a small part in the movie. She played the pit girl, the girlfriend of John C. Reilly's character, Buck Bretherton.
I think Donna was there for emotional support as much as anything else. Don was so nervous about his acting and being able to perform that he made sure production paid Donna to stay on for the whole shoot. He was just so on edge about playing Aldo. One night, he'd be out till 4 a.m. at a club, and the next night, he'd be out jogging in the street with two assistants driving behind him, flashing their headlights for oncoming traffic. He was like Stallone playing Rocky, trying to cut weight.
Don's relationship with Donna Wilson would soon fall apart.
The cocaine had taken over. The pressure was just too much.
Not just for Don, but for all the key players. Robert Towne was trying to prove he was a commercial screenwriter. Tony Scott was trying to prove he could top his work in Top Gun. Tom Cruise was trying to prove that this wasn't a Top Gun sequel. For years, Don had hired first-time directors and actors that weren't yet movie stars and screenwriters that he could hire and fire as he pleased. But Don couldn't push these guys around.
When he did try and assert his clout, he created a dust-up with Tom Cruise. A big dust-up.
The dust-up was about Tom's voice.
I don't exactly know the details about the fight between Tom and Don. What I had heard was that there was a piece of recording equipment called Clear Sound.
Invented by the head of Scientology himself, L. Ron Hubbard. L. Ron had apparently used the equipment when he was recording with his band, the Apollo Stars.
That's their concern, not mine, my friend. They're free to fantasize.
According to Hubbard's U.S. patent 571-0685, he registered ClearSound as an apparatus for reducing distortion during recording in a tape recorder.
Scientology founder David Miscavige offered the ClearSound rig for $100,000. Don laughed. Was he serious? They had a perfectly good sound rig for $5,000. What the fuck did they need a ClearSound rig for? Don was pissed. He wasn't going to be pushed into paying $100,000 for a piece of recording equipment. He'd already given them $25,000.
Don felt he had already been burned once in paying out $25,000 for Scientology classes. Don would say no to Clear Sound, which meant saying no to Tom Cruise. Incidentally, Tom would later persuade Ron Howard to use Clear Sound on their film Far and Away. And on A Few Good Men, director Rob Reiner used the Clear Sound system for Tom and another system for the rest of the cast.
I think the whole Clear Sound incident carried over into Tom's annoyance with Don's acting.
For Tom, who had just come off Color of Money working with Paul Newman and Martin Scorsese, and Rain Man with Dustin Hoffman, Don's lack of preparation was frustrating.
Don's only preparation for his role was to be able to fit into a really cool racing suit. It was about looking the part. He'd lost the weight, he'd done the facelifts, he'd had the deep suntan, the hair was flowing, the teeth were whitened. He looked like somebody who looked the part of Aldo Benedetti. Unfortunately, he just couldn't play the part.
When Tony Scott saw Don's performance in dailies, he knew he had a problem. Somebody had to tell Don.
Don was a sensationalist and an egomaniac. But when it came to making movies, Don was also a brutal realist. And when he saw himself up on the screen opposite Tom Cruise, his heart sank deep into his chest. He knew. He knew that he really, really sucked.
Don knew it. Tony knew it. The editor, Billy Weber, knew it. And Tom Cruise, he really knew it. There was no getting around it. Aldo Benedetti needed to be cut from the picture. But Don couldn't face the music. He had lost too much weight and had too many surgeries to not have at least a keepsake image of his handsome self on the screen, not to mention the embarrassment of having to tell his friends and foe in the business that he had been cut out of his own movie. In the end, all we'll ever hear from Aldo Benedetti was one line of dialogue. "I'm glad he's well enough to come back, and I hope I beat him at the same time." That was it. One line in an interview with an ESPN reporter. Aldo would die in a car crash, a crash that made absolutely no story sense and would cost production thousands of dollars, all so that Don could save face. The long and chaotic production of Days of Thunder would finally wrap in late May of 1990, with just over 5 weeks for a post-production that normally would last 5 months. The composer Hans Zimmer, who had flown out for a job interview during the film's pre-production, had never left and was said to be holed up in a custom sound studio built by Don.
Hans had to finish the music, Billy had to finish the edit. They actually had 4 edits going on at once, but in the end, everybody just ran out of time. They were locked into that July 4th release date. It was a real crusher. The movie suffered for it.
Days ended up making half of what Top Gun had made, $170 million, or $300 million when adjusted for today's inflation. It was a financial success by any standard, but for Don's and Paramount's. Frank Mancuso was so upset over the production that he terminated Don's $300 million deal, and he demanded that Don pay back $9 million of his profit earnings for what he perceived as budget overages.
Ironically enough, as grim as things were, it wasn't a bad time for everybody. Tony and Tom, for instance, both fell in love on that picture.
Don's girlfriend, Donna Wilson, she would leave Don for Tony Scott. They would marry and start a family. And Tom Cruise would fall in love and marry Nicole Kidman.
But for Don, there was no love. I've never seen him in a lonelier, darker place than after Days of Thunder. He'd failed as an actor. He'd failed as a producer. He had hit rock bottom. I didn't think it could get any worse. But of course, it did.
The Don Season 2 is executive produced by Will McCormick and David Harris Klein. Klein also wrote and created the series. Mike Jurasitz is the editor, sound designer, and producer of the series. The podcast is produced and narrated by Malaya Rivera-Drew. That's me. Louis Weymouth voices the character of Pierce and also produces the series. For more episodes of The Don Season 2, listen to the series on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you listen to podcasts.